only VHF station between Atlanta and Miami. The newspapers in Jacksonville, owned by the railroad, were second-rate, so the town came to rely on WJXT as the principal source for news, and this remained the case for many years until NBC went on the air with a station that had 12 owners, providing negligible competition. Even today, with massive competition, WJXT remains dominant in the market. After John Sweeterman came and began to take hold of the business side of the company, Phil was freer to turn his attention to news and editorial. On the news side, he would have liked to have correspondents overseas and felt the Post wouldn't be doing a proper job in the capital until we managed that. Many of the editorial issues with which the Post was dealing had to do with the increasing anxieties about communism in those years after World War II. The political right kept manipulating America's fears in a demagogic way, and the atmosphere grew more poisonous as the Cold War grew more intense. The fear of communism, on which Joseph McCarthy and the political right fed just a few years later, was palpable everywhere, and the Post took strong stands from the beginning, which wasn't easy for a paper operating on the economic fringe and fighting for its life. The attacks on us for being liberals or even Reds began then, and rarely ceased over the next several years, adding greatly to both our financial problems and our distinction. There were, of course, genuine strong reasons for anti-communism, both at home and abroad. At home, the party had succeeded in establishing a surprising network of infiltrators and even spies. Abroad, the Soviets were being very aggressive all over Europe, especially in Berlin, and in 1948, the communists took over in Czechoslovakia. Obviously, there were real concerns, but the political exploitation and misuse of them were shameless. The Post had begun to cover the House Committee on Un-American Activities, or HUAC. By the end of 1947, we were under fairly constant attack for our attitude toward the committee's activities, and the editors felt the need to respond to those attacks. One editorial put the Post's position succinctly. This newspaper's criticism of the committee has been directed consistently at its methods rather than at its aims. Because the committee, under successive chairmanships, has equated loyalty with conformity, has concerned itself with opinions rather than activities, has disregarded the most elementary rules of fair play in dealing with witnesses, its conduct has seemed to us to be more dangerously un-American than that of any of the groups or individuals it has investigated. An article that appeared in March 1948 in a conservative publication called Plain Talk attacked the Post as a Trojan horse for totalitarianism, following the Communist Party line on most major issues, and assailed Phil especially as a constant apologist for the paper's editorial policy. The piece also censured Herblock and charged Alan Barth, unmistakably the ideological guide of its editorial page, with adherence to the party line. Phil was so enraged that he considered legal action, dismissing the idea only when he learned that Plain Talk had no capital. Instead, he wrote an 8-page memo to the Post's staff explaining that the diatribe had been written by a disgruntled Post employee who had been let go, and laying out facts to show the complete absence of any basis for the opinions expressed in the article. When we were assaulted as communist sympathizers or even dupes, our competition in Washington was only too happy to jump on, or even jump-start, the bandwagon of censure. Both the Times-Herald and its relative in Chicago, the Tribune, attacked us relentlessly. The Tribune called the Post alternately a defender of the Reds and a spokesman for the Truman administration. They were hoping to undermine us with our readers and advertisers. Backing the reporting and commentary, as well as Herblock's strong cartoons, while trying to protect our economic lifeblood, took a lot of courage and judgment on Phil's part. In August of 1948, the Post's Mary Spargo reported that HUAC had summoned Whitaker Chambers, a former member of the Communist Party, but then associate editor of Time magazine, to testify. Chambers said that he had once belonged to but had quit the Communist Party, and in his testimony he named some U.S. officials as acting for the Soviets, among them Alger Hiss. The Hiss affair ignited controversies on every side. Late in 1948, He was indicted for perjury after having denied passing secret documents to a communist spy ring, the statute of limitations precluding the stiffer charge of espionage. After a very public trial with passions running high, he was convicted in a second trial and sentenced to a 5-year prison term. The Post had editorially noted that Hiss had threatened to sue if Chambers' charges were repeated off the floor of Congress. They were, and we challenged him to sue Chambers, which he did, hence the trials. The Post was attacked from both sides for its coverage of the Hiss affair. Many of our friends criticized Phil and the paper for being too timid and less than objective. Our friend Jim Rowe, for example, wrote Phil several scathing letters, including one in which he said, "For pure snide newspaper writing, the Post is the equal of the Times Herald in its news columns. I think Alger has a lot of explaining to do. Why not let him make it in the forum of the Baltimore court and keep your bias out of the piece until then? All I suggest is objectivity. I don't know the answer, but neither does the Post, and I expect more of the Post than other papers." Phil responded, agreeing that Rowe had caught us with our objectivity down, but adding, "There were no bad intentions involved, just some silly judgments, and we are wistfully hoping that we shall learn from experience." On the other hand, we were attacked for a moderate editorial comment by Merlo Pusey to the effect that Hiss had the misfortune of being tempted to betray his country in an era of widespread illusions about communism and of being tried for perjury in connection with his offense in a period of Cold War when the pendulum of public sentiment had swung far in the other direction. That does not excuse him or minimize the enormity of the crime of which he has been convicted. Merlo was referring to the era of the Popular Front, when liberals viewed the communists as allies in the world's struggle against fascism, which appeared to be and was then the major threat. When Secretary of State Dean Acheson was asked to comment on Hiss's conviction in his second trial, he made his famous comment, "I do not intend to turn my back on Alger Hiss, whom he had known well for years." The Post, in an editorial entitled Conflict of Loyalties, was critical of Acheson's statement, saying, "Mr. Acheson has played right into the hands of the yammerers in our midst who are trying to rend our society with the Alger Hiss conviction as the instrument, has indeed given them a handle. Judgment was obscured when Secretary Acheson decided to yield to a personal sentiment." Two things followed, both indicative of Phil's dilemma over dealing with these delicate issues for the paper. Some Acheson supporters, who were good friends of ours, Paul Porter, Joe Rao, Oscar Cox, and Thurman Arnold, wrote a letter to the editor of the Post supporting Acheson's statement as an act of personal courage and a declaration of principle rare in past history and virtually unprecedented in these times. Felix Frankfurter also wrote to Phil on the very day the editorial appeared, "A free society implies a free press, and a free press implies a free editor. Feeling these truths very deeply, there have been instances in the past, as there will doubtless be in the future, when I have vigorously defended you against the charge of responsibility for editorial views that, for one reason or another, aroused criticism on the part of friends of yours. The occasion for these remarks is, of course, the editorial in this morning's Post, Conflict of Loyalties. You do not need to be told that the views which it expresses run counter to many deep convictions of mine, not the least my conviction about the duty of the press. To worry lest uninformed people will disregard weighed words or that yammerers in our midst will make a misuse of them and therefore to deplore a manifestation of moral clarity is to join the misinformed and the yammerers. I had supposed that the press enjoys its constitutional status because its duty is to enlighten and not to submit to darkness." The Hiss case dominated all our minds. It was all we seemed to talk about. One night, Scotty and Sally Reston came to dinner, and as they sat down in our library and reached for a drink, Scotty said, "Shall we talk about something else for 5 minutes, or shall we get right down to business?" So, contrary to the perception of those attacking us from the right that the Post was a liberal, left-leaning paper, we were being assailed by those on the left, who felt we were too conservative and not vigilant enough in speaking out against right-wing excesses and in defense of civil liberties. In fact, there was a mixture of views on the editorial page, but Herbert Elliston and Phil were the deciding voices. The Post, indeed, had sympathized with Alger Hiss during the early stages of his trials, but as more and more evidence came to light, had come to the conclusion that he was a cool and cynical perjurer. The year 1948 was the first election year for Phil and me as controlling owners of the Post, and we went together to both political parties' conventions that summer. Conventions are fascinating to attend as journalists and certainly as publishers, more so then than now, when everything is decided in the primaries. To find out what's going on behind the scenes, you have to know people and be able to maneuver in crowds, to meet and exchange views with politicians and journalists from all over the country. In 1948, we were still young, and the Post was still relatively unknown. Everyone else looked important to me, and Phil and I went around with my father, but even he was somewhat at a loss. I remember seeing Henry and Claire Booth Luce come into a restaurant in Philadelphia and thinking how important they looked. And indeed they were. I was very excited to be there, but felt very new and small. In the Truman-Dewey election, the Post maintained its tradition, begun under my father's independent ownership, of not endorsing a candidate for the presidency. Rather, the paper commented editorially on both major candidates. We criticized Dewey's statements indicating that he would turn over a large measure of control of atomic energy to private industry and praised his statements about the Berlin blockade. We criticized Truman for suggesting that Dewey was a totalitarian and agreed with a great deal of his denunciation of the Congress. The last Gallup poll published before the election gave Dewey a 5 percentage point lead over Truman. When it became clear that Truman had indeed fooled the pundits and pulled off a political miracle, Phil, having spent much of the night at the office, sent off a telegram to the president, which he printed on page 1 of the morning after paper. "You are hereby invited to attend a crow banquet, to which this newspaper proposes to invite newspaper editorial writers, political reporters, and editors, including our own, along with pollsters, radio commentators, and columnists, for the purpose of providing a repast appropriate to the appetite created by the late election. The main course will consist of breast of tough old crow en glace. You will eat turkey." The Democratic National Committee has agreed to furnish the toothpicks to be used by the guests, who, it is feared, will require months to get the last of the crow out of their teeth. "We hope you will consent to deliver the address of the evening. As the Dean of American Election Forecasters, and the only accurate one, it is much desired that you share with your colleagues the secret of your analytical success. Dress for guests of honor, white tie. For others, sackcloth." The president was highly amused, responding, "I received on the train, back from Independence, Missouri, your very handsome invitation to me to attend a crow banquet. I know that we could have a good time together, but I feel I must decline. As I said en route to Washington, I have no desire to crow over anybody or to see anybody eating crow, figuratively or otherwise. We should all get together now and make a country in which everybody can eat turkey whenever he pleases." Truman also added, quite magnanimously, "Incidentally, I want to say that despite what your commentators and polls said, your news coverage of my campaign was fair and comprehensive." What was most important for us personally about the 1948 election was the terrible trouble in which our great friend Pritch found himself. In the Kentucky Senate race that year between the Democrat, Virgil Chapman, for whom Pritch didn't even particularly care, and the liberal Republican, John Sherman Cooper, whom he liked, he did an incredibly wrong and foolish thing that ruined his life. Someone came to him and asked him to sign some ballots with faked names. And Pritch did. In April of 1949, Pritch and his law partner, Al Funk, were indicted under the criminal code and charged with conspiring to impair and dilute the effect of the votes cast for the Republican candidates for president, senator, and congressman in Kentucky in the general election the previous year. Pritch pleaded not guilty, but though Funk was ultimately absolved, Pritch was sentenced to prison for 2 years. Phil and other friends of Pritch's tried to help as best they could. They collected and sent money, which was always in short supply with Pritch, but particularly so as his lawyers prepared appeals and his own source of income, his law practice, ceased to exist. but the appeals, on which Joe Rao and others had worked tirelessly, failed. When the first judgment was affirmed by the United States Circuit Court, the case was appealed to the Supreme Court, which affirmed the lower court's decision for lack of a quorum on June 5, 1950. Pritch filed a petition for executive clemency, asking for a pardon or commutation of sentence, but he went off to prison and served 5 months of his sentence before being pardoned just before Christmas of 1951 by President Truman, largely at the behest, ironically, of the very decent Senator Cooper, who had won the race against Chapman, for whom Pritch had stuffed the ballots. Our hearts were broken for our friend. We were dumbfounded. Here was the man among us, most destined for greatness. Yet now he'd been found guilty of so stupid and irresponsible an act, and was off to prison. It was hard to understand how such a distinguished mind could have done such a shocking thing. As Pritch told a reporter in 1979, "I got to feeling, perhaps, that I was bigger than I was, that the rules didn't apply to me." My own inclination is to believe that, flawed as he was in character, Pritch let his desire to be one of the boys overcome his intelligence and his judgment. He had perhaps been too successful at too young an age, and had lived a pattern of permissiveness and laxity, which had always been the despair of his many friends. Even after he got out of jail and began to make a scratchy living, he occasionally neglected to finish work that had been contrived especially for him. Some of his old habits of not always fulfilling his part of any bargain endured. Yet still we loved him. Somehow one couldn't help it. He wrote Phil from prison that, "While I have many moments of bitter self-reproach, I cannot afford the excess baggage of feeling sorry for myself or plotting revenge against those who may have treated me badly, though I hate them plenty." He found the prison to which he was assigned to be as good as one could hope for, mild in its discipline, and a comfortable enough stopping place. In the end, he regained his influence in Kentucky as head of an education commission appointed by Governor Ned Breathitt, which succeeded in implementing important education reforms. He regained his life and died in 1984, the heroic figure we had envisioned, enduring his many afflictions with great courage and continuing to function despite being diabetic and becoming blind. From the turn of the new decade, politics seemed to heat up. On February 9, 1950, Senator Joseph McCarthy launched his campaign against a so-called communist conspiracy to subvert American life. Phil's first response was to dismiss McCarthy's tirades and the senator himself. A few months after the beginning of McCarthy's invective, Phil said of the senator, "McCarthy is causing a lot of noise here and doing a lot of harm, but I am hopeful that he will eventually end up on his backside." Phil had to tread a fine line in this very difficult time. He had been an ardent liberal, but in this period when he was fighting for the life of the paper, he was clearly becoming more conservative and more anti-communist, mostly, no doubt, in response to events in the real world, but also, to some extent, in response to the constant attacks on the paper and on him personally. Outsiders didn't realize that Phil had many problems with the internal politics of the Post during this period, some of which stemmed from the increasingly differing political views of Phil on the one hand and Alan Barth and Herblock on the other. For example, a real brick fell on Phil's head one day in the spring of 1950. He and I were returning together from New York by train, and he was going through the Post. Suddenly, reading an editorial he knew to be written by Barth, Phil went ballistic. In this editorial, Barth had commended Earl Browder, the former Secretary General of the Communist Party in America and the Communist candidate for the presidency in 1936 and 1940, for defying a special subcommittee of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that was trying to compel him to disclose the names of his former associates conspiring against the United States. Barth was a brilliant and brave defender of civil liberties and constitutional rights, but in his appropriate concern for the right of privacy, he tended to minimize the real dangers of communism. All the paper's top editors and managers were alarmed at the stick we had handed our enemies with which to beat us. And, of course, beat us they did. The Times Herald dubbed us Browder's organ. Phil was so deeply upset that he wanted to fire Alan immediately. Luckily, During one of our Sunday morning visits to Frankfurter, Felix quietly but firmly persuaded him not to. But several days after the editorial appeared, a note was printed in the paper, regretting it. The tensions between Phil and Barth remained. Several months later, Phil wrote to my father that he had been changing or killing a lot more editorials than usual, almost entirely Barth's production, and he was worried that Elliston would think they were having differences. Phil met with Elliston outside of the office to review the general situation and philosophy of the editorial page, explaining that he was extremely concerned about Barth. As he wrote to my father, and as he told Elliston, he did not want to slip into being a namby-pamby paper like the New York Times, but at the same time I did not want to throw away the prestige and the power of the paper by getting in trouble on minor fronts through sloppy work. Eventually, however, Phil calmed down and lived with Alan Barth, who went on to be a great adornment to the page and to the post. Joe Rao later said of the terrible strain between Alan and Phil, "I think Phil was really quite frightened in the McCarthy period, when the Post was losing advertisers, by the possibility that he, an outsider, might lose the paper. I think he didn't really analyze some of the problems with Alan, like whether Alan was right or wrong. Phil felt a responsibility for the Post over and beyond the normal responsibilities of life, because it wasn't his. I think he had been given this thing, and he damn well was not going to let it go. He was not going to let it die." I'm not sure exactly when Phil began to think in terms of Eisenhower as a possible presidential candidate, or even whether he came to this himself or was influenced by someone, possibly my father. In one letter to Pritch, who preferred Dewey to Eisenhower but was convinced the Republicans would win in 1952 no matter who the candidate was, Phil urged him not to be too anti-Ike, admitting that he himself had been until Eisenhower's last visit to Washington, when Phil met him at a small private lunch for newspaper men and began to change his mind. By the summer of 1951, Phil was so disgusted at the idea of more leadership on either the Truman or the Taft level that he joined my father in becoming a strong Ike man. Dad was convinced that Eisenhower has the one thing that we have been looking for in recent years. It is generally described as character. Although independence was the watchword at the paper, the editorial line clearly began to back Eisenhower, and on March 24th, the Post endorsed him over Taft for the Republican nomination. Herbert Brownell, Ike's unofficial campaign manager, close friend, and later attorney general, called the endorsement the most effective journalistic blow that had been struck for Ike. The endorsement caused waves everywhere, not least within our family. My father's health and strength had begun to fail, and he was feeling out of the loop and insufficiently consulted, despite Phil's best efforts to keep him involved in the paper and the company. Apparently, in the case of the endorsement, Phil had neglected to bring my father, who was in Florida at the time, into the decision and in on the timing of the editorial. Dad was understandably unhappy at not knowing in advance that the Post was going to endorse. My mother wrote Phil that something had to be done to build up my father's ego and restore his self-confidence, that he was feeling fairly useless. On the very day the editorial appeared, Mother followed up with a private, anguished letter to Phil, saying she was worn out trying to keep my father on an even keel and chastising Phil for not having included him. There is no record of Phil's response, but clearly he must have taken her words to heart. Following this letter, he wrote Dad several times in great detail about various issues involving the paper, consulting him on different matters, from a proposal to revise the format of the editorial page and the women's section to the idea of a rotogravure section for the Sunday paper. I was concerned about my father's hurt feelings, but I confess that I identified completely with Phil and with the pressures under which he operated, even though I differed with him about backing Eisenhower. Phil and I went to the conventions that summer, both of which took place in Chicago. Eisenhower was nominated, and Phil was of course happy with the victory. I see now that we all regarded Taft as too much of a right-winger and an isolationist. The latter he was, but his political views were really moderate, far-sighted, and decent. Our fears at the time were very real, however, and seemed very valid. I was slightly more skeptical than Phil about Eisenhower. I suppose, somewhere deep inside, Phil was seeking recognition as an independent, in contrast to his liberal history. My own political views never changed much, and usually made me support the Democratic candidate, although I was and am a centrist. When in 1952 the candidate turned out to be Adlai Stevenson, I had no doubt where my allegiance lay. Like many people of my general persuasion, I was swept away with excitement by Stevenson. I well remember the impact of first seeing him at the convention. I thought he was marvelously charismatic, and was immediately enthusiastic about him. His acceptance speech, made in the late hours of the night, and with its rather pretentious biblical quotation about the cup passing from his lips, was electrifying. The Post editorialized that, for Stevenson, the office chose the man. Phil, of course, knew how I felt. In a letter to a friend at the end of the summer, he wrote, "I confess that my wife, since seeing Adlai the Adorable, has shown signs of being a crypto-democrat." Despite my excitement about Stevenson, however, I was under no illusion about the possibility of his winning. Adlai's ambivalence about the presidency, both wanting it and not wanting it, was his Achilles heel. For a politician to equivocate about his desires regarding the presidency disqualifies him, I later realized. But in the summer of 1952, like so many of us, I was overwhelmed by this extraordinarily articulate, witty man. Phil, on the other hand, was fervently embracing Eisenhower and the Republicans. That summer he got to know Richard Nixon, who had been taken on as Ike's vice presidential candidate. Phil was impressed with him and thought he would be a big help in the campaign. Nixon had lunch in midsummer with Phil, Russ Wiggins, and my father, and Phil reported to a newspaper friend that the three of us all felt that he is obviously a person of major talents, whereas I and most of my friends were deeply concerned about his red-baiting victorious early campaign against Helen Gehagen Douglas and about his pronounced right-wing proclivities and seeming sympathy for McCarthy. Throughout this campaign, Phil was constantly having to defend both the Post's endorsement in the primaries of Ike over Taft and his own surprising political views. To those who chided him about his strange bedfellows, his comeback was to suggest they might shake up their own sheets and take a look under the covers. Yet even though the paper was supporting Eisenhower, Phil tried, as he said, as carefully as is humanly possible, not to be prejudiced or blind to the qualities of Stevenson or some of the weaknesses of the Republicans. Among the weaknesses of the Republicans was the failure of Eisenhower to speak out against McCarthy and the excesses of the right wing. As far as I was concerned, the last straw was added against Eisenhower in the now well-known incident involving General George C. Marshall, whom McCarthy had been viciously attacking. Ike's decent instincts came to the fore, and he had apparently decided to defend the general in a speech on one of his campaign swings through Wisconsin in early October. Wisconsin Republican leaders, however, leaned on Eisenhower's political counselors to dissuade him from making the favorable and supportive comments. Ike, still relatively new to politics, gave in to his advisers and eliminated the paragraph, but did this so late that the whole affair became public. I had remained open-minded until then, but now I was solidly for Stevenson. Although Phil, too, was shocked at Ike's lack of strength in standing up to McCarthy, my views didn't worry or influence him, nor his me. Our political differences didn't come between us personally. We each understood where the other one was. Phil's direction of the Post during the campaign stirred up some resistance and problems from within the ranks of the staff. At some point, several staffers wanted to run an ad in the paper declaring themselves for Stevenson, but Phil apparently talked them out of it. Most important, he and Herb Locke had quite a struggle. Herb's cartoons had always been searing and powerful. He had first drawn Nixon in a cartoon on May 16, 1948, in which Nixon and two others, all dressed as Puritans, were pictured building a fire under a chained Statue of Liberty and saying, "We've got to burn the evil spirits out of her." As the campaign heated up, and Eisenhower wasn't speaking out against McCarthy, Herb Locke drew cartoons that were clearly at odds with the editorial support the Post was giving Ike. Phil was incensed by many of these cartoons. One that he refused to print depicted Eisenhower saying, "Naughty, naughty," to Nixon and McCarthy, who were drawn as two smear artists with buckets and dripping brushes in their hands. Finally, during the last weeks of the campaign, Phil had the cartoons dropped from the paper altogether, the last time I believe this ever happened. Instead, he used reprints of earlier cartoons. Since the cartoons ran elsewhere in syndication, this ploy was not only ineffective, but embarrassing. In late October, the Washington Daily News carried an article headlined, "Where's Mr. Block? One of DC's top drawers is missing." On the other hand, it's easy to see why Phil felt he had to take action. It's hard for a publisher trying to espouse a certain cause in the paper to have such powerful cartoons running on the same page and dominating print. Even so, Phil later acknowledged to Herb Block that he had been mistaken. Phil became more and more actively involved in the election itself, so much so that he actually campaigned for Eisenhower a few times. On October 30th, he served as master of ceremonies for a Citizens for Eisenhower rally. To keep Phil company, I went with him to at least one Eisenhower rally, including one where Phil spoke, but I sat silently. I can't justify Phil's actions, but publishers did this kind of thing more often then. For instance, John and Mike Cowles, publishers in Des Moines and Minneapolis, were big contributors to, as well as activists in, Ike's campaign. On election day, November 4th, we watched the returns at the Rouse. Ironically, probably our most liberal friends. Phil was thrilled by the result. However, he wrote Stevenson a few days after the election, "If you'll permit an expression from a black soul of the one-party press, I would like to say that yours was a campaign you and your sons can be proud of. In any event, even in opposition, I was proud of you from your first remarks on Astor Street to your closing comments in Springfield. My wife, over whom you have control superior to mine, joins me in wishing you, A, an immediate rest, and B, a fruitful future." By now, McCarthy was growing even more sinister and more powerful. Playing on fears stemming from the Cold War, he made outrageous charges, many within the protected confines of Senate or congressional hearings, or just before newspaper and television deadlines, so that all that got on the front page or the air was the charge itself. After a while, we in the media learned to carry the other side and to put his charges in perspective, but he was a new phenomenon with which the press had to learn to cope, and it took a while to catch up with his methods. Much of Phil's time was taken up with the McCarthy menace. The fear of communism remained pervasive, and attacks on people for being sympathizers or liberals even, much less genuine communists, continued to stir up serious trouble. Editorially, the Post was highly critical of McCarthy's positions and attacked him regularly. Most effective of all, probably, was Herb Block's series of cartoons depicting McCarthy and his various outrageous activities. It was Herb Block who had coined the word McCarthyism on March 29, 1950, using it as a label on a tar barrel. Taken together, the Post's comments against McCarthy represented a very clear and brave position, and the paper took a lot of heat for its coverage. In fact, the war between McCarthy and the Post was vicious and frightening. We were helped to a certain extent by Joe Alsop and his brother Stuart, whose column had become important to the Post, and whose anti-communist themes helped soften the perception of the Post as somehow sympathetic to the communists. Perhaps, too, some of the criticism was blunted because of the paper's support of Eisenhower. This was offset, however, by criticism from the left that we were not doing enough about McCarthy. Once Eisenhower was president, he became one of those who Phil felt was not speaking out enough, and he became more and more disenchanted with the president's lack of response to McCarthy and the climate he was nourishing. Walter Lippmann had been an enthusiastic supporter of Eisenhower, but his wife Helen, like me, had been a renegade for Stevenson. Sometime soon after the election, the four of us were together, and Walter asked Phil, "What are we going to do?" At the same time, he turned to Helen and me, saying, "And you, shut up!" We laughed at the two men's dismay over White House passivity. Phil was constantly badgering Sherman Adams, the president's chief aide, to try to get Eisenhower to take stronger stands. Since the Post was still fighting for its life economically, Phil felt very pressured by forces he couldn't control. One of the principal forces over which he had little control at this time was my mother. Like Barth and her block, she was unrelenting in her condemnation of McCarthy and his reckless charges. She despised him vigorously and publicly, calling him variously a perpetual adolescent who has never matured, a warped personality who is now revenging himself upon a society which he feels has never been fair to him, and a gangster type. In worrying that insinuations and accusations by anti-communists were going to get people thrown out of their jobs without hope of reinstatement, she felt that such behavior put America on the road to something worse than a Gestapo. Her answer was to look to the Post to handle the situation and to pressure Phil to try to save our democratic freedoms. She argued, not illogically, "What is the use fighting totalitarianism abroad if we are going to imitate its worst aspects here at home?" But as usual, her passion was excessive and uncontrolled. Shortly after the inauguration, my mother delivered her strongest blast yet against McCarthy, this time to 17,000 school administrators in Atlantic City, warning that the Congressional Committee investigating schools and colleges threatened not only academic freedom, but American democracy itself. In this speech, she called McCarthy our modern Grand Inquisitor, a dangerous and ruthless demagogue, a political adventurer, and a psychopath, and compared his tactics to those of the Bull Ring. An article on her speech, along with her photograph, appeared on the front page of the New York Times. An Illinois congressman, the conservative Harold Himmel Velde, counterattacked her as having written a warmly pro-Russian letter to Pravda. The charge was false. The letter had been written by a Mrs. G.S. Meyer of Canada. The Post, of course, defended her, and Velde retracted his claim, but not before the Times-Herald had picked up and used the accusation. Not content with taking on McCarthy, Mother often took on the Catholic Church for its stand on education. She viewed this as a just cause and herself as an intrepid warrior for public education. But it was Phil and the Post who paid the price in counterattacks of a serious kind, such as a boycott, a burden which Phil viewed with some outrage as an unnecessary one in the circulation and advertising struggle. Just as he occasionally pulled back editorials and cartoons, so too he had to rein in my mother now and then. One notable time came in 1952, when he disowned a speech she made in Detroit condemning attempts by the Catholic hierarchy to support sectarian schools. He felt the speech would be construed as anti-Catholic. Mother had warned Phil that she would be making this speech. "I hope it makes no difficulties for the Post. I have written to Wiggins to write the news report on it himself so that he can play down whatever he wishes to." Among the things she said that raised red flags for Phil: "The Roman Church is building up a Catholic state within the state. It can end only in the ultimate catastrophe of a Catholic political party. No human being can blindly accept authority in one area of life and become self-reliant in day-to-day decisions in the field of morals, politics, and economics. The secular public school trains independent minds for leadership in every area of life. The parochial school trains for obedience to authority. We must close the door tight against the present attempts of the Catholic hierarchy and reactionary Protestants to force our people to support sectarian schools whose rapid increase would destroy our secular school and tear our nation into irreconcilable factions. The costs of private and parochial education are mounting steadily. Few American girls wish to become nuns." Phil was so alarmed that he was going to issue a press release stating that my mother's views were her own and not to be confused with those of the Post. Following Russ Wiggins's advice, however, he softened it to a statement to be read as coming from her, which he hoped would be picked up by the press. "The views expressed in my Detroit speech are my own and do not reflect the opinions of the Washington Post. I do not participate in the formation of editorial policies." The question then arose as to how to reach her, since she was on a night train returning home. Russ knew the editor of the Buffalo Evening News, Alfred H. Kirk Kirkhofer, and got him to board the train there at a water stop at 2 a.m, wake her, and get her to sign off on the statement. A long, feisty exchange of letters followed between my mother and Phil, all written out by hand. Typically, she depicted her situation as unbearable and asked rhetorically what she was to do. "I can't live in hell at home. I can't worry Butch unnecessarily. I mustn't hurt the stockholders of the Post, Butch's major fear. But I might as well stop all my efforts to create community solidarity, to strengthen the public schools, and to defend my country against a foe no less dangerous than the communists, if I have to shut up about Catholic political ambitions." She ended her letter by telling Phil not to bother to reply, but suggesting they must get together for a good talk. He sent back a 14-page handwritten response. Rightly or wrongly, he didn't agree with her analysis of the urgency of the problems you see arising from the American Catholic Church. "I doubt if Freud, Jung, and Bill Meyer could find out whether my position results from fear or objectivity, but I at least am unaware of the fear." At the same time, he knew that her speech would cause considerable hostility to the Post. He believed there had to be a sense of priorities about the number of wars the Post was willing to engage in, and saw his obligation as defining the priorities with an overall institutional point of view. So the question for him was why the Post should carry another burden when it is not one our institutional thinking makes necessary. Even though he felt his most odious bias is toward being Pollyanna, Phil concluded that time and tolerance and thoughtful discussion have worked out many a tough problem, adding, "If we could simply agree to disagree, it would be easy, but we're hooked, which makes it both more complicated and more fun. For the fact is that you cannot be only an individual apart from the Post any more than E.M. can, or K., Elliston, Wiggins, Graham, et al. We'll have to compensate our occasional partial losses of individuality by recognizing the merits of the overall institution." So the potentially searing episode was gradually put behind all of us. When this kind of drama arose, I experienced no emotional complications. I was 100% behind Phil and in accord with his views about the family tensions, as indeed most of the time was my father. Many emotions flared up in this period of McCarthy's heyday. Friends fell out with each other, rows erupted on every side. One notable argument close to home took place in March 1952 at a lunch at Joe Alsop's. Although the details are lost to me now, I recall that it was a small luncheon party with friends, including Isaiah Berlin, who was here from England. Whatever the specifics of the argument, at some point Phil exploded with anger, and he and Isaiah fought loud and long. I believe Phil eventually stormed out of Joe's house. Joe was furious with Phil and wouldn't speak to him. Isaiah thought Phil had been incredibly rude and called to tell him so. Phil wrote Isaiah that the boorishness at lunch was inexplicable and inexcusable, plain bad manners. He added in his own way of apologizing, "I only hope that by now you may believe it had nothing more to it than that I am an occasional sufferer from a tendency to get one's mouth in high gear before one's brain turns over." Phil and Joe made up as well, but their relationship was not without further arguments and letters flying back and forth. In mid-1953, for example, they got into another terrible fight at Joe's house over the issue of taking the Fifth Amendment rather than testifying. That time Joe followed up with a letter of apology and explanation. "I have searched my memory of our conversation to uncover what might have offended you, as so obviously you were deeply offended. As nearly as I can disentangle our discussion, you may perhaps have thought I was teasing you because you are now a successful man. Well, in a minor way, I suppose I am too." Joe's reference to Phil's being a successful man, and thus forgetting what it was like to be poor, obviously touched a more sensitive nerve than any of us understood at the time. It came out later, when he was ill, that Phil resented the way he had been helped to his successful forum. But his abilities were clearly so extraordinary that none of us suspected the insecurities that lay beneath the surface. One great loss for us and for the Post was that Herbert Elliston's heart disease forced him to resign in 1953 as editor of the editorial page. In a farewell interview in the paper, Herbert said he had no guiding principle to leave, but if he did, it would be a line from Somerset Maugham: "If a nation values anything more than freedom, it will lose its freedom, and the irony of it is that if it is comfort or money that it values more, it will lose that too." Herbert had been the editor for 13 very distinguished years. Phil immediately went after our friend Scotty Reston to be Herbert's successor. Phil's offer to Scotty sent the New York Times into action to keep him there. The result was that Arthur Kroc moved out of the way to allow the Times to make Scotty its Washington bureau chief. From Scotty's point of view, that wasn't even necessary. His response to Phil was simply to say, "I can't leave the Times." At that point, Phil surprisingly turned to the youngest member of the editorial staff, 34-year-old Robert Estabrook, to run the editorial page. At about the same time, he cajoled Al Friendly, whom he considered one of the paper's top reporters, to be assistant managing editor for the daytime. This provided Russ Wiggins with the first real backup he had ever had. For a distinguished reporter to become an editor is one of the most difficult transitions, both for the person and for management. The two jobs require different skills, and naturally, some reporters make the transition and become able editors, and some don't. There is no good way to know except to try. For too long, the Post was not very good at helping people to learn to be managers. But though Al missed reporting, he took up the challenge of management with enthusiasm. The pattern of our lives was changing. As the busyness increased, I tried to find ways to give Phil some relief. Because both he and I had had strong negative reactions to the summer of 1949, when we tried to take the children away to New England, Phil to the commute, and I to the life of women and children all week without their men, we decided to look for a summer retreat closer to home. I had concluded I'd take any house no more than 20 minutes away from Washington, and in the summer of 1950, we rented a house in Warrenton, Virginia, a bit farther out, but still acceptable to me. Phil liked it so much that we rented another house in the fall to continue country life on weekends. I would probably never have done any of this had Phil not insisted. He loved the country, and the children thrived on it. I was less enthusiastic, having never lived this way. It meant a lot of work for me every weekend to pack up the children, the household, the food, and later the dogs. But Phil pronounced it all such a success that we started to drive around the countryside looking for a place of our own. Our dream was a house about an hour from Washington, with a few acres around it to protect us. Just before Christmas, Phil remarked that he didn't think I really wanted to find a place, and asked whether there wasn't anything I'd seen that I liked. I had indeed liked one place in Marshall, Virginia, but had thought it was too big and too expensive. In addition, it was a working farm, which I didn't want to take on and run. As I set out again on the search, after New Year's 1951, the agent told me that the place was still for sale, they'd come down in their price, and the farm part was rented out, so the farming was taken care of. We went back to look at it again, and as happened with our house in Washington, we fell in love with it, the house and the land. Glen Welby, as the house was called, is located in a secluded area halfway between Warrenton and Middleburg, Virginia, about an hour and 20 minutes from Washington. The house was set in the middle of 350 acres, about 60 of which were woods. We bought Glen Welby for $87,500, a sum that is ridiculously small when looked at today, but which seemed a really large undertaking for us then, particularly since the house needed a lot of restoration and repairs. And, of course, I had to furnish it completely. The house was a real family house, large and sprawling. The center part probably dated to the early 1800s, and the back room had been added by the time of the Civil War. A kitchen wing followed, and a large living room and master bedroom and porch had been added by the former owners in 1929, just before the crash. It was typical of our marital relationship that Phil conceived the idea of a country house for summers and weekends, and I did the actual work. Our relationship resembled that of a chief executive officer, Phil, and a chief operating officer, me. He had the ideas and spark. I carried them out and ran things. Despite the extra work for me, I'm grateful to Phil for this idea of buying the farm. It's now a familiar phenomenon for those who can afford weekend country life on a greater or lesser scale. But then it was much less common. My son Donald and his wife Mary now own Glen Welby and spend time there with their children in much the same way we did. On the social front, we were getting to know an ever wider number of people. I lunched with a variety of women, many of whom were close friends. At one point, Phil noticed that there was always a three-way morning conversation among Polly Wisner, Evangeline Bruce and me. He dubbed this the 9 o'clock network and said he was going to buy time on it. Yet, despite having a circle of friends, I was still maladroit at managing our social life. Because Phil was consumed with work, he was strict with me about how many invitations to accept for the evenings. At first, I rather stupidly told people I would consult Phil about whether we could accept. He insisted that I just tell them no, pointing out how hopelessly awkward it appeared if I hesitated or said I'd ask him. I remember once saying, "Shouldn't we go? I've said no to the French embassy 5 times already," to which he quickly responded, "What's wrong with a sixth?" One day he came home to Glen Welby with an invitation from the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to go out on the Sequoia, then the official government entertainment boat, which he said he'd regretted. "Why?" I asked. "It sounds like fun." His response, "It sounds like fun, but think who's going to be there?" Whereas Phil was disinclined to accept invitations, once he got wherever we were going, he usually enjoyed it hugely and was reluctant to come home. I, on the other hand, initially would want to go much more than he did, but often felt uncomfortable or shy once we got there. One example during these years was the dancing class, an old Washington tradition that had been started by Mrs. Joseph Leiter's mother, known as Ma Williams. The dancing class was the ultimate snobbish social event, and rules for entry were excessively rigid. Politicians were not among those invited to attend. Truman's vice president, Alban Barkley, and his young wife, Jane, were turned down, for example. Someone once wanted to invite Richard Aldrich, the producer, but this request was turned down because it was feared he might want to bring his beautiful actress wife, Gertrude Lawrence, who was in town with the King and I. I confess I wanted to be included. Janet Barnes, our close friend who had grown up with all those people, proposed us to the committee, and we were accepted. I suppose I may have wanted to be accepted because of my childhood and because I knew that my parents had not been members. I suppose I may also have liked the idea of the class because the rest of my life during those years seemed so unglamorous. Houses, children, boards, and good works. Phil could not have cared less, but typically rather enjoyed the whole thing once we went, whereas I was usually overcome by an outbreak of nerves and the old fear of getting stuck with a partner on the dance floor. I remember Phil telling me, with some impatience, that it was up to me to take care of myself, that if I got stuck with someone I should just say goodbye, walk away, and find someone else. It didn't do to be passive and feel sorry for myself. Our public life kept me busier than ever, accompanying Phil on trips, social and business dinners, post-related activities. I kept less careful track of my own activities than I did of Phil's. Yet, although it may have seemed prosaic to those looking on, I really loved the life I led. I went on writing the magazine rack for the Post until 1953, when I just couldn't cope with all that I was doing, and, against Phil's wishes, gave it up without really discussing it with him. He said, "I hear you've resigned. Have you gone to the competition?" What I was doing was a good deal of fundraising for local groups and serving on several boards dealing with welfare and children's issues. And naturally, my own children were taking up a great deal of time, the usual endless carpools, mothers' group meetings, birthday parties, riding and tennis lessons, field days, dogs, doctors' and dentists' appointments. In 1951, at a time when Phil was away, I found I was having another miscarriage. He seemed always to be away on these occasions. I went over to Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore the next day, and after a minor operation, was sent home sad and depressed. But Phil, following a reassuring call from the doctor, reported to my mother that I was really in very good shape, both physically and mentally, although the only slightly upsetting thing about the development is that it frustrated our perfect time schedule. In April 1952, I had our fourth and last child, Stephen. Mother wrote me a note 2 months later, on my birthday. 35 years ago, you gave your parents great joy by coming into the world, and now that lovely baby has 4 lovely children of her own. May your own astonishing tribe give you as much satisfaction and happiness as you have always given us. And she sent along what she called her usual little check. She wasn't exaggerating. It was a small check, like those she sent throughout my life. In fact, Mother was very unwilling to take any trouble with gifts, or to give something sizable, except, of course, for the huge business-related transactions that involved the post company. Many Christmases would go by in which she would shake her head about the state of the world and say that things were much too serious to bother about Christmas. Or she would say, "Darling, please buy the children something lovely from me," usually after I had finished Christmas shopping, leaving me to choose something we were giving and sign it with her name. Unfortunately, she never learned to derive pleasure from giving. In fact, she had a streak of real discomfort at parting with things. I responded in various odd ways to this inheritance, overdoing Christmas and birthdays with a neurotic concern that a child not be disappointed, or giving inadequately myself until I learned from Phil's lavish generosity and from observing friends. Our relationship with my mother and father continued to be close, yet difficult. The connections among the four of us were no doubt complicated by all the various hats we wore with each other, whether child, spouse, parent, friend, mentor, benefactor, or some mix of several of these. Dad was to celebrate his 75th birthday in 1950, and my parents had gone to Europe, so Phil and I were charged by my mother with planning some event to mark the occasion. What we came up with was a small party for him with his grandchildren, and then a dinner for over 100 friends the following night. Mother had commandeered her friend Rudy Serkin to play the piano in Dad's honor, and the speeches were all appropriate and gratifying. In his, Joseph Pulitzer said that, of the many bankers and industrialists who had owned newspapers, Eugene Meyer was the first who turned out to be a natural newspaper man. Bernard Baruch spoke of his acumen, General Omar Bradley about his public service, and Steichen paid a touching tribute to the whole family. It was all a great success. Because both my parents loved occasions and celebrated them to the utmost, we always seemed to be having these ceremonies for their birthdays or wedding anniversaries, or anniversaries of the post's founding or of my father's acquisition of it. Sometimes we would return from halfway around the world for these events. There was always considerable pressure to arrange them, to say nothing of attending them. Rituals in one's life often start accidentally and then perpetuate themselves as a pattern. We developed several happy rituals in those years. Because Phil saw so little of the children, we began to take vacations with them. An early one, in St. Petersburg, Florida, turned out to be my introduction to baseball, since the Yankees trained there, and we watched the exhibition games. After that, and because of Don's passion for the game, I learned to enjoy baseball and even keep score, because this was something both Phil and Don liked to do. After we bought the television station in Jacksonville, we began going to a beautiful beach half an hour from town. For several years in a row, we spent 10 days there right after school let out for the summer. Directly on our return from Florida, we would give a party at Glen Welby for post people to celebrate the anniversary of the purchase of the paper. It started with the 20th anniversary, but became an annual event, and a large burden on me at the time, since I still hadn't learned how to organize people to get the work done. The caterer did a great deal, but I used to weed the garden, tidy up the house, get my neighbor to arrange the flowers, and generally run around worrying over all the details, including how many portable toilets to bring in for 150 people. We printed a newspaper about my father's achievements and the post's progress, which Lally distributed, riding astride a tiny mule someone had left with us. Don, displaying a capitalist streak, collected small parking fees at the end of the lane. Given all his responsibilities and interests, and despite his native abilities and skills, Phil was stretched very thin, which took a toll on his endurance and his health. He suffered from numerous illnesses, increasingly so as the years went by. There were moments of strain between us, mostly when he drank too much, after which, almost inevitably, a rather violent quarrel would ensue, followed by abject apologies and diminished drinking, or even a temporary period of no drinking at all. Whenever I saw the drinking begin, I started to freeze. Dreading the inevitable fight, I grew over-worried. Probably I could have handled these situations better if I had been calmer about them, but I couldn't be. He was usually guilt-stricken, especially if there had been a sequence of unpleasant episodes. One such difficult evening occurred in the spring of 1954, when we were co-hosts at a large party we all referred to as the Bankruptcy Ball. Tom and Joan Braden had come to town. Tom, good-looking and attractive in a craggy way, had been in the CIA, and Joan was extremely strong, sandy-haired, blue-eyed, with a mysterious hold on the opposite sex. The party was in a huge but almost empty house across the Potomac, on the Virginia side, where the Bradens were living at the time with the first few of their 8 children. The hosts, Stuart and Tish Alsop, Joe Alsop, Paul and Phyllis Nitze, John and Joanne Bross, Frank and Polly Wisner, and ourselves, each contributed $400 toward the expenses. The party was a lot of fun, but for me it was one of those all-too-frequent nights when Phil had too much to drink. On our way home from the ball, he told me to stop the car, got out and walked for a while, fuming, with me driving slowly alongside. Finally, he got back in and we went home. The subject of his drinking was never openly discussed. When he was drinking, you couldn't talk about it. When he went on the wagon, I always hoped for future restraint. The fights were never in public. The rage would explode after we had left a place, and was usually about nothing substantive, nothing concrete that we could discuss. Rather, he seemed to seize on something as an excuse to vent his rage, which built up because of all the pressure he was under. Certainly these incidents could have been early signs of his later illness, but I never suspected that Phil was either ill or depressed, or that that might have been the reason for his drinking. Despite these difficulties, I was completely immersed in Phil's life. He always had a strong desire to communicate, and hated being alone, so I accompanied him almost everywhere, and at home he liked me to sit and talk to him, even when he was in the bathtub. Consequently, I was very aware of everything in his day's work, whom he had seen, what he'd done, how everything was going. He was particularly good at recounting what took place at his many stag evenings. His memory was so photographic that he could recite whole conversations or recreate entire evenings in minute and fascinating detail. It was almost better than being there, since he had a great sense of what was interesting and funny, and a great aversion to what was tedious and boring. In the early days, I often drove him down to the office or back, or both. Many late evenings, I would sprawl out on the sofa in his office while he worked. We did very little apart from each other. One memorable time when I did do something separate was not soon repeated. Barry Bingham, owner of the Louisville Courier-Journal, who had become a friend, had invited us to the Kentucky Derby, but just before we were supposed to leave, Phil said he felt fluish and took to his bed. When I called the Binghams to tell them we couldn't come, they suggested that I come alone. I distinctly remember being very surprised at being asked on my own, and I was reluctant to leave Phil when he was ill, but he insisted that I go, so I did. The weekend was an endless sea of parties and races, with the one important race happening so quickly that it was bewildering for someone new to racing. Still, I had a very good time, only to return to find Phil in a fit of anger. He admitted that, yes, he had urged me to go, but of course he hadn't meant it, and hadn't liked being left alone in his sick bed. Again, as with his drinking, I interpreted Phil's delicate health and constant illnesses as the result of the strains on him and the fraught competitive situation of the company. Looking back, I can see that these illnesses, too, were likely connected with his more basic health problem, of which there was no real sign yet. In retrospect, I realized that the more difficult moments were definitely connected with mood swings. But I, and indeed the world, was dazzled by him. His wit, great energy, soaring imagination, and fervent desire for excellence, in himself and in others, were so strong that I ignored the fact that he was frequently using that wit at my expense. Phil was often critical or cutting in his remarks when things weren't just right, either about the house or my clothes, for example, which left lots of room for disparaging remarks. Oddly, what I never perceived at the time was that, though he was lifting me up, helping me in so many ways, he also had a way of putting me down which gradually undermined my self-confidence almost entirely. Nonetheless, Phil was the fizz in our lives. He was the fun at the dinner table and in our country life. He had the ideas, the jokes, the games. He operated on the theory that it was important to do with the children only those things he himself enjoyed. No dull board games, but hunting, fishing, walking. His ideas dominated our lives. Everything rotated around him, and I willingly participated in keeping him at the center of things. In fact, I agreed with almost all his ideas. I remember once I was complaining about having injured my knee by stepping on a ball on the tennis court. Feeling rather sorry for myself, in a plaster cast in the hot summer in Washington, I whined about, why couldn't I have stepped an inch to the right or an inch to the left of that ball? I will always remember Phil looking at me, smiling, and saying, think of the ones you've missed. Not what I wanted to hear at that moment, but a truth that stayed with me for life. He always managed to get right through to the heart of the matter. I learned such a lot from him, from the way he lived. His energy was infectious. He didn't suffer fools gladly, as evidenced in his failure to mince words. I recall one night at the start of the Eisenhower administration when the new Secretary of the Treasury, George Humphrey, and his wife came to dinner at our house. I overheard Mrs. Humphrey telling Phil what a great sacrifice George had made to come to Washington. To my horror, I heard Phil respond, "Would you mind if I told you something frankly, Mrs. Humphrey?" "Not at all," was her reply, quite rashly if she had known Phil better. "Well, Mrs. Humphrey," Phil said, "making that remark in Washington is like belching at dinner in Shaker Heights. We think it's quite a privilege to be Secretary of the Treasury." Needless to say, our relationship with the Humphreys never progressed much further. As for the post, all our worrying and all of Phil's efforts and hard work were beginning to take effect. The paper had its problems, to be sure, particularly over labor issues. The late 1940s had witnessed several short strikes and work slowdowns by the pressmen and stereotypers. Nevertheless, we were publishing ever larger papers, occasionally equaling or even surpassing the Star. Important moves had been put in motion to improve further the paper's quality and profitability. A television magazine boosted circulation. Better technical resources in the new building allowed us to print a finer paper. Experiments in using color on the paper added a new dimension. A broader profit-sharing plan for more employees gave people a real sense of belonging. The paper had come from bankruptcy to break even, more or less, with huge advances having been made in the business area, especially after John Sweeterman's arrival. As Phil wrote to John, "How great are the obligations of this entire newspaper to you! You have done all and more than I ever hoped for, and, wonder upon wonder, you have done it so quickly and calmly that many are unaware you have done it. You can be certain I am not among them." Despite McCarthy and the whole atmosphere of the Times, which jeopardized the future of an independent newspaper, we were experiencing the highest advertising and circulation increases in our history, and great gains on the news and editorial side contributed to the Post's being increasingly widely recognized. It's a salutary nod to humility to realize just how much progress had been made by my father and by Phil with so few resources and such enormous odds against them. In the end, my father's concentration on the basic principles had paid off handsomely. The year 1953 had been an especially good one for the Post, which Phil characteristically played down by saying it does not mean we are ready for retirement, but at least we are a couple of steps ahead of the sheriff. What made the outlook even better was a letter my father received in the beginning of 1954, an event that led up to what I still think of as the defining moment for the company, the unexpected acquisition of the Times-Herald. The letter was a confidential one from his friend Kent Cooper, former general manager of the Associated Press, who was living in retirement in Palm Beach. Dad arrived at our door that morning, waving the letter in his hand, obviously excited, asking, "Where's Phil?" I explained he had gone to Jacksonville. "I've got to talk to him right away. This is really important." My father then went to the Post, where he threw the letter on John Sweeterman's desk and asked, "What do you think?" The letter read simply, "I am wondering whether you expect to be in Palm Beach any time soon, for I would like very much to talk to you about a business matter of importance to you." Sweeterman replied, "I'm probably thinking the same thing you are." They both knew that Cooper was a good friend of Colonel McCormick's, that he lived near him, and that he was likely talking about the Times Herald.
"Well, why don't we find out?"
replied my father, and immediately put in a phone call to Cooper. Cryptically, he asked,
"Kent, this business matter to which you refer, is it in the field of journalism?"
Cooper said that it was.
"Is it in Washington?"
my father probed. Again, Cooper said yes. This was the moment we had fought for, worked for, and prayed for since 1933. After the disappointment in 1949, when the colonel had stepped in, our hopes that he would sell it all, much less sell to us,